This is KBOO Portland, your community radio for northwestern Oregon, southwestern Washington, up and down the Willamette Valley, and out the gorge. Coming up, we'll get an update from Gaza, where a 72-hour ceasefire has ended this morning, and talks for a long-term truce are at a standstill. KBOO's Jenka Soderberg hosts this live program, which also includes analysis on the U.S. role in all of that. At 10 on Air Cascadia, host Chris Andre is joined by Richard Silverstein, the progressive Jewish magazine Tikkun, the founder of that. Followed at 10:15 by Flashpoints with host Dennis Bernstein, and followed in turn at 11 by a special edition of The Digital Divide. That's all right here on KBOO, your community radio station. And thank you to all our members. You keep KBOO strong and independent. Dependent only upon the audience and accountable to the audience. If you're not one of those people to whom KBOO is accountable, you can remedy that at kboo.fm. Click where it says donate today.
KBOO Community Radio and Triangle Productions are proud to co-sponsor the return of Medicarefully Fabulous. Friday, August 8th through Saturday, August 16th, Medicarefully Fabulous will return to the Sanctuary Theater for a limited engagement. The show is a series of original stories about aging, faith, friendships, and recovery. Again, that's Medicarefully Fabulous, Friday, August 8th through Saturday, August 16th at the Sanctuary at Sandy Plaza, 1785 Northeast Sandy Boulevard in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
That's Fairuz singing Chudni, which means take me. I'm Jenka Soderberg, joining you live this morning on Political Perspectives. A 72-hour ceasefire that began on Tuesday in Gaza expired this morning at 8 a.m. And since Gaza is 10 hours ahead of Pacific time, it's been out of accordance with the ceasefire for 11 hours now. At 7:45 this morning, F-16 fighter jets began flying over the Gaza Strip, and a few seconds after 8, bombs were reported in different parts of Gaza. At 8:01, sirens began to sound in southern Israel to warn residents of incoming shells fired by the Palestinian resistance. The shells were fired by the Islamic Jihad, which took credit for those shells. The armed wing of Hamas said that its fighters have not fired any rockets since the ceasefire began on Tuesday. The armed wing of Hamas did, however, release a video statement as the 72-hour ceasefire came to an end, saying about Israel, quote, "They think they can continue to manipulate the people, to continue to violate international law, but they withdrew their army because they realized a ground invasion into Gaza is like sinking into quicksand. We will not accept to have this battle ended without a real end to the aggression in all its forms and a real end to this siege and the establishment of a port in Gaza. Anything else is a deceit and an attempt to negate the sacrifices of our great nation. Third, we strongly believe our demands do not need negotiations. They are humanitarian rights, basic rights, guaranteed by international law, and therefore we call on the Palestinian negotiators not to accept any extension of the ceasefire without accepting our legitimate demands." The statement from the armed wing of Hamas continues, "If our demands are met, we can extend the truce and then hold talks on details and technical issues. If Israel refuses our demands, we demand the Palestinian team to end its talks and not be part of Israel's manipulation." We are joined this morning by Mohammed Al-Khatawi. He is in Gaza and is joining us for an update. Mohammed, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you. Thank you so much.
Can you tell us the situation now in, I understand you're in Gaza City after this ceasefire has ended this morning?
Yes. Actually, after ceasefire have been declared since 3 days ago, has been expired today morning at eight morning local time, and after that we heard from the news that the Islamic Jihad and other brigades fire rockets towards Israel, and as well as we heard a lot of bombardment and explosion from Israeli war plan made a couple of airstrikes, at least in my area, and according to what it's shared through media agency, until the moment we have five dead person and more than 31 injured people after the ceasefire has been expired.
And
but the situation in general, it's a little bit quiet and calm, not as much as what's happening in the beginning of the offensive against Gaza.
I understand the first person that was killed after the end of the ceasefire in an Israeli bombardment was a child, Ibrahim Zuhair Adawasa, a 10-year-old child, and he had been taking shelter in a mosque, and that was the first target of the Israeli bombardment after the ceasefire ended?
Yeah, actually, if we are having shaded have a look on the results of casualties on the Gaza Strip, the majority of them, and according to UN statistics, more than 80% of them, they are from civilians. And we are, if we go deeply, we can find a huge percentage among these number from children. If we are going to be more accurate, until today, we have 1,800 or 900 almost of death murders or dead people, and more than 9,800 wounded people. Among of the dead people, we are talking about 430 children and 250 women, and among 9,000 injured people, we have almost 3,000 children have been wounded during the aggression or offensive operation against Gaza. So we are talking about a huge and massive number of civilians have been as a victim of this offensive operation.
Mm. Wow. And the targeting of mosques, has that been a very active part of the Israeli bombardment over the last 30 days now, this fact that the first target after the ceasefire ended was a mosque? I understand that many other mosques have also been targeted.
Yeah, a lot of mosques actually have been targeting, and we are not going to focus on the mosque because it's belonging to Muslims. In Gaza City, as you probably know, Gaza has It's not that much a wide area. It's a small area. It's like around 1,360 square meters, which is considered as a highly densely populated area in the world. Israeli, during this operation, has been targeting everything. They are targeting civilian homes. They are targeting mosques, schools, even a UN facility. If you look at the UNRWA statistics, they show a highly percentage of damaging on their facility on the Gaza Strip. And Israelis keep claiming that the resistance movement here, I'm not talking about Hamas or Al-Jihad Brigade, I'm talking resistance as a whole. When armed, they keep targeting everything. For example, once we talk about the paramedics or medic facilities, they are also keep bombardment or targeting the ambulances and everything's on the ground actually.
So during the 72-hour ceasefire, people were able to go into some of these areas that have been no-go zones for several weeks, and places like Shujaiya and Khuza. Can you talk about what it's been like going into these areas that were so heavily bombarded and had been inaccessible before this ceasefire?
Yeah, at the first moment, we have been afraid that is a trap from Israel, because we have used to that Israel does not adhere or commit to any ceasefire and use this ceasefire to gather people and kill them. So at the beginning of the declaration of the ceasefire, the people start to go back to that suburb or area close to the border, for example, Shujaiya neighborhood or Khuza. Personally, I go to Shujaiya to look at what's happening in Shujaiya, and I've been shocked. There is no Shujaiya anymore. You cannot find any signal or any, anything you can realize that this is the area, because a huge, massive area has been destroyed totally, especially when you go to the eastern, the area which is the closest to the Israeli border. Personally, I go to check out my aunt's home, which is belongs to Salem Shamali, if you may know them. And I guess you know Salem Shamali from the story, has been released through the social media and even through different media agencies.
Yes, and I wanted to ask you about that, but maybe if you tell what was the consequence and what his family home looks like now, and then we can talk about the loss of your cousin, Salem Shamali.
Regarding to his home, it consists of two stories. And actually, I can tell you that more than 80% of the home has been destroyed. It's not going to be used anymore, especially the second floor. It's totally demolished, because a lot of rockets from the heavy artillery and from Israeli tanks have been shot on that area, actually. So once we get in there, we couldn't find anything to reveal or to take it with us outside. And Sam's father, he said, I prefer if they try to destroy the whole home in a space of keeping a lot of walls just stand up. I lost my memories. I lost my hope. I kept my 64 years old to build that home, and spent my whole life with my two wives and with my sons here, and now I get nothing. My merchandise has been fired and destroyed and spread everywhere. This is what happened for Sam's family, actually. This is an example from what happened in Shijaiya and other areas also.
So many homes destroyed. We have heard there's at least 10,000 homes that have been destroyed.
Yeah, according to initial statistics, has been released through the media. Because, you know, until now, we didn't go to live a normal as usual, because we still live under offensive. But initial report says that we have at least 10,000 houses have been destroyed between partially and totally, and among of them, I think if I'm not wrong, 5,500 houses have been totally destroyed. So here we are talking about a lot of families, like 400,000 families has been displaced, and nowadays they have no homes to go back to live in there.
Wow, and huge swaths of areas have just been completely reduced to rubble, like the area of Shujaiya that you're talking about. I wonder if you could talk about your cousin, who I guess it was on July 22nd during a brief ceasefire that the incident took place, in which your cousin was killed. And I wonder if you could talk about how you found out about your cousin's death.
Okay, actually, my cousin's story is too painful and reflects how much the Palestinian has been living under suffering inside Gaza, especially besieged, blockade area, consists of like 2 million people living there, are prohibited to connect with the people outside Gaza, even with their relatives. For example, my parents live outside. They cannot came to Gaza even to hang on their first grandson. And going back to Salem's story, on 20 of July, Salem's family evacuated as many as people from Shujaiya to the downtown, regarding to what Israeli soldiers asked them and declared that will be. Something happened to Shujaiya area. And once they left Shujaiya, Salem heard on a local radio station an SOS from his relative. One of them has been wounded and the other still stuck at his home. And at that time, actually, there is a temporary ceasefire declared from Israeli side. And he goes to Shujaiya and he found a couple of activists belongs to International Solidarity Movement, and he asked them to help him to bring back his relatives. They agreed and goes with Salem to his area, and actually he starts shouting at it's clearly crystal clearly in the video. He's calling for his cousin, for his first cousin, and after that he crossed the green line or theoretical green line, as the Israeli soldier has been testimony for a former Israeli soldier, and after that the Israeli sniper get an order from his boss to kill Salem, and after that Salem receives 3 bullets. Actually, we didn't know what happened to Salem for more 2 days. We keep looking for Salem because he's still missing, and we go here and there to ask anyone from Salem's neighbor or relatives if they know anything about Salem, but the answer is negative, and no one know about Salem anything. We keep goes to Al Shifa Hospital, which is the largest medical compound in Gaza, to looking out in the manifest among the wounded or the dead people names, but the medical staff told us there's no Salem's name inside the manifest. After that, after 2 days, at 5 a.m., my sister, the electricity came to my home for 3 hours period a day, and she opened her Facebook account, and at that moment, she found a video under the title that a young Palestinian killed by Israeli sniper. She pressed the play button, and because the slowdown, the internet connection is not so good during such time because of electricity and other technical factors. So we have to wait until the video have been loaded up. Once the video started, Salem's sister recognized Salem's voice, and she's shouting, "This is Salem's voice." And that moment, whole Shannon's family, I'm talking about like 25 people, have been in my home because they left their home towards my home, which is a little bit safer from their area. We are gathered, we are stick together and keep staring in the laptop monitor. We found Salim, and at that moment, we've been a glimpse of hope that Salim is still alive. And I realized one of the activists who has been with Salim, and he's an American activist. His name is Joe Catron. At that time, I tried to contact Joe, but there's no network coverage. At that moment, the video keeps going, and at the end of the video, all of us have been shocked that Salim has been shot by 3 bullets, and he's carrying his cheap phone, cell phone, to try to contact with his family, but he couldn't make any of course. And the activists cannot even bring Salim back, and the Salim's body still there for almost 6 days until the International Commission for the Red Cross, tried many times to bring Salim's body, but no way. They go to that area twice, and we provide them with the GPS coordinates because we are having the footage, which is the video have been captured by iPhone device. And as you know, the iPhone device, the device could provide you with the time, date, and also the GPS coordinates. We provide the ICRC with the GPS coordinates to go directly to Salim's location. But once they reach far away, like 100 meters from Salim's body, they dryly fire a couple of mortars on the ICRC cars. And here I'm talking about violation. Again, another violation, not against Palestinians, against the international bodies.
And that's like the ICRC, the Red Cross, the International Committee of the Red Cross. And they were trying to retrieve his body.
Yeah, exactly. But they failed, actually. And Salim's body is still there for 6 days. And after, on 26th of July, we goes with the Palestinian Red Crescent Society to bring Salim's body. And we found Salim's body in another place because a lot of rockets have been hit that area. And his body keep moving from one side to another side. Once we bring Salim's or took Salim, his body has been partially decomposed, and he goes to a Shifa hospital, to the morgue. At that time, we asked the doctor to provide any evidence as much as he can to keep it for suing the Israeli soldier. But unfortunately, even we couldn't carry the Salim's body because it's, as I mentioned before, decomposed. And, you know, it's hard, but I have to say it. No one from Salim's family can say goodbye for Salim. Once we are heading to bury his body, his mother, his sister, his brother, just me and Salim's body and a couple of his uncles and brothers-in-law. We go alone and the drones buzzing overhead to bury Salim's body. Yeah. So that what happened. And just recently, there is an article released on a website belongs to Channel 4, which is British media or British TV, said that a former Israeli soldier has told Channel 4 News some information about Salim's death. He had listened to testimony from the soldier or from the Israeli sniper who killed the Salim's. And they said that they received the order from their boss, if that guy, even if he does not threaten us, according to their testimony, if he crossed the green line, just shoot him. And this article has been published on the 7th August, so talking about yesterday.
Mm.
So that was happening with Talents, and Talents family now they have no homes. Talents has like 9 sisters, 4 brothers, and his mother, and also mother-in-law. Because Talents' father has two wives, because the first one cannot does not have boys. She just received girls, and Hassan's father waited for 11 years after getting married another woman and received Salim as a first crown. And by sudden, he found his missing son killed in front of his eye. And once he called the international community to help him to bring Salim's body back to bury him as any human being, no one can help us.
Wow.
And help him without even saying goodbye.
So your cousin Salim killed on July 22nd during a so-called humanitarian ceasefire and shot by a sniper, and you finding out about it on Facebook, the whole family gathering around to watch this Facebook video. What an incredible story. And I wonder, it's such a difficult and tragic moment for the family, and to hear about just one of these 1,900 people who've been killed over the past month. But can you tell us a little bit about Salim and who he was in his life?
Okay, Salim, he had like 23 years old, and he has 9 sisters and 4 brothers. Salim's father, like 64 years old, and he's an old man. Salim has 2 mothers, actually, his real mother and mother-in-law, as I mentioned before, because the first mom, Salim's mom, cannot receive sons. She just received daughter. She just received a girl. Salim's joining a college to in order to receive a diploma in accounting, but he couldn't make it because their financial circumstances is not so good. So he used to join the college for 1 semester and postpone it for another in order to help his father in daily life accommodation. His father opened for Salim like a small shop in the old city market to depend on himself and also to help himself in paying college fees. Salim's as a person as a outside description, he's a tall guy with lovely green eyes. He loved to play football, actually, and he used to support, if I'm not wrong, Barcelona football team. He's supporting and fan of Barcelona football team. He used to work hardly to help his family, and everyone in his family loved Salim because he's so kind and so patient. Salim used to gather money, and every single time when he come back to his home, he make a show to buy some candies and biscuits, if you may, to distribute it among his nephews, and everyone in our family loved Salim, actually. Everyone.
Wow. So the story of Salim Shamli, one of the 1,900 people killed over the last month in the Israeli assault on Gaza, a 23-year-old who was killed by a sniper while searching for his relatives in the Shujaiya neighborhood. His death was captured on video and posted on Facebook. He was unidentified at the time that video was posted, and Mohammed is telling us about seeing that video as his family gathered around and discovered that was Salim. Many of the stories of the Palestinians who have been killed over the last month are on a website called beyondthenumber.org. So Palestinian victims of this attack are not just numbers, but are humanized, and their stories are made real for people here. One of the messages that you gave in a previous interview, Mohammed, is how the people of Gaza are just like us here in the U.S., and these attempts to say that you are different are untrue. And I wonder if you can just talk a little bit about that and what these key demands really are for this ceasefire, opening of the port. What does that actually mean for people on the ground, opening the borders and ending the siege?
You know, living under the siege for more than 7 years, you cannot go through Rafah border. We have only one border to link our people with outside, because from air, I mean, the crossing between Gaza and Israel have a lot of restrictions for people to cross from and out. And so the only gate for our people here, for 2 million people, is Rafah crossing, you can say, totally closed during 360 days for a year. People here living for 7 years under blockade, no access to international or cannot access abroad, no goods, a little bit of goods can be exported and imported, and the unemployment rate is getting higher. People just receiving electricity in the best circumstances. We receive electricity for 8 hours a day. So during that 8 hours a day, I know in the U.S. you can find your day, it's consists of 24 hours, but in Gaza it's only 8 hours. During the 8 hours, you have to turn on your washing machine, you have to iron your clothes, you have to send in the businesses faxes, you have to check out your emails, you have to communicate with others abroad, you have to do everything during that 8 hours. The water also, it's totally linked with the electricity. If the electricity is turned on, so you have water. For the moment, I don't have electricity. I don't have water. After more than two weeks, I just can turn on my washing machine to wash my clothes and my son's clothes, actually. You know, the situation here, we feel that no one can stand with us. We're just hearing about the international law and the international humanitarian law, about the UN resolution and Geneva Convention and the Human Rights Organization, and some people keep defending women and children's rights and to be a human being. But all these terms and words does not exist in Gaza specifically and in Palestine generally. We have been living for 30 days and more than 30 days actually under the disproportionate weapon, and some of them it's illegal and forbidden by international. But when it comes to Israelis, unfortunately there is a double standard. The Gaza people consist of children, women, elders, and a lot of people who are not involved in or affiliated into political life. But unfortunately, no one can say any words when it comes to Israel. How can you imagine if the story belongs to Israeli family? I think the whole international community will came and maybe I guess they will throw an atomic bomb on Gaza to destroy every single centimeters in order to revenge their son. Imagine your son killed in front of your eyes and you found him by chance on a video through the social media.
Wow, and nothing can bring back your cousin, and no words can bring condolences for what's happened. But I do want you to know, Mohammed, that people in Portland are thinking about you, and that the people of Gaza, well, may feel like you are alone, are not alone. And I want to thank you so much for joining us on KBOO and for telling this really poignant story, and for maintaining your presence in Gaza. And that in itself is a form of resistance as the Israeli military tries to wipe out the Palestinians and push them off of their historic homeland. Thank you so much, Mohammed, for joining us. We're going to go out with a song, "We Will Not Go Down in Gaza," by Michael Hart. And when we come back, we will be speaking with Allison Weir about the U.S. role in the ongoing Israeli assault on Gaza. If you had not heard yet, the 72-hour ceasefire ended this morning, and five Palestinians have been killed by Israeli bombardment, 11 wounded as well. Islamic Jihad has fired a number of rockets into Israel, none causing any injuries or damage, but the ceasefire is currently on shaky ground. Thank you, Mohammed Khatawi, for joining us.
Thank you. My pleasure, sir.
A blinding flash of white light lit up the sky over Gaza tonight. People running for cover, not knowing whether they're dead or alive. They came with their tanks and their planes, with ravaging fiery flames, and nothing remains. Just a voice rising up in the smoky haze. We will not go down in the night without a fight. You can burn up our mosques and our homes and our schools, but our spirit will never die. We will not go down in Gaza tonight. Women and children alike, murdered and massacred night after night, while the so-called leaders of countries afar debated on who's wrong or right. But their powerless words were in vain, and the bombs fell down like acid rain. Through the tears and the blood and the pain, you could still hear that voice through the smoky haze. We will not go down in the night without a fight. You can burn up our mosques and our homes and our schools, but our spirit will never die. We will not go tonight.
Michael Hart, "We Will Not Go Down in Gaza." We have been speaking with Mohammed Al-Khatawi from Gaza for an update on the end of the ceasefire this morning. We're joined now by Allison Weir. She is the head of If Americans Knew and the Council for the National Interest Foundation to speak about the U.S. role in what's been happening in Gaza. Thank you so much, Allison, for joining us this morning.
Thank you for having me.
And we're going to start out by just playing a clip of Cynthia McKinney, a former U.S. Congress member, about the pressure that was put on her as a candidate and then as a member of Congress by the lobby that encouraged her to support the type of policy toward Israel that this far-right lobby promoted.
I did not toe the line on U.S. policy for Israel.
What line is that that they wanted? Were you told directly that you had to toe a line, or explain that to me?
Well, every candidate for Congress at that time had a pledge. They were given a pledge to sign. And I was new on the scene. And so the pledge had Jerusalem as the capital city, the military superiority of Israel.
American Congress people have to sign this pledge.
Yes, you sign the pledge. If you don't sign the pledge, you don't get money. So, for example, it was almost like water torture for me. My parents observed this. I would get a call, and the person on the other end of the phone would say, I want to do a fundraiser for you. And then we would get into the planning. I would get really excited because, of course, you have to have money in order to run a campaign. And then 2 weeks, 3 weeks into the planning, they would say, did you sign the pledge? And then I would say, no, I didn't sign the pledge. And then my fundraiser would go kaput. I made it public. This probably nobody had said anything about it, but I made it public. And then, you know, the excuse was, well, you know, those were just overzealous advocates for Israel. So then the tactic changed. And but this is what is done for 535 members of the United States Congress, 100 senators, 435 members of the House of Representatives have to now write a paragraph, which basically says the same thing. So it's not a pledge, but it's a paragraph, and you post it, and, you know, there are these forums you have to go to at the synagogues or whatever. And then, you know, if you don't perform appropriately, then you don't get money to run your campaign. The problem is that it requires an awful lot of money to run a campaign. And whether it's a woman's organization, an environmental organization, people can read about this on the internet if they're interested. If you go to thomas.loc.gov, that is the official United States Congress website. And if you put in the name Gus Savage, because Gus Savage was a black member of Congress who was targeted by the pro-Israel lobby. And he had the foresight to use his position as an incumbent in the House of Representatives to put his experience on the congressional record for the entire existence of the United States Congress now. People will be able to access his experience. And what he wrote was that it was the Garden Club of New Jersey that gave his opponent $5,000. But it wasn't really the Garden Club of New Jersey. It was the activists who were associated with AIPAC, the American Israel Public Affairs Committee. Well, the district that I initially represented in Congress, I represented so many districts because redistricting was a tool that was used to target me, to eliminate me from the Congress. But the district that initially sent me there was a district that was comprised of rural blacks in the Black Belt of Georgia. These are people who have not had access to equal opportunity at all. The district was challenged in the Supreme Court. And with the assistance of the Anti-Defamation League, the district was dismantled. It generally takes about $250,000 minimum to take a case from filing up to the Supreme Court. And the people who filed the lawsuit to dismantle, they challenged my ability to represent the people of that particular district.
Who were these people?
Well, actually, interestingly, there were five white citizens, one of whom had been the white male candidate that I defeated in the Democratic primary. And they were aided and abetted by the Anti-Defamation League. And when the case arrived at the Supreme Court, interestingly, on the same day as an environmental case, the Spotted Owl case, The Supreme Court decided that the habitat for the spotted owl should be protected, but that the black voters in that district could have no protection. And so the district was dismantled.
Well, I have, because of the notoriety about me telling my story, and then, of course, the public positions that I've taken, supporting the human rights aspirations, the legitimate rights and the aspirations of the Palestinian people, I have a target on my forehead. And that then means that every means that is available to the pro-Israel lobby will be utilized to make sure that I do not ever occupy a position of authority. Now, fortunately for me, there is a very large peace community that is interested in change. And they would like to have a tested, experienced voice representing them in that very hall of Congress so that they can at least have their voices heard, even if they can't change the policy. But being there is the first step to having the policy changed.
The voice of former Congressmember Cynthia McKinney on the role of the Israel lobby in Washington. And Allison Weir is with us on the line. Cynthia McKinney claims that she has a target on her forehead for supporting the rights of the Palestinian people. Is she just being paranoid, or is there evidence to support this claim of the pressure that she talks about that's on U.S. Congressmembers for supporting Palestinians?
Oh, there's a great deal of evidence that this is going on now and has gone on for years. It crosses party lines. The first person to really expose this was a Republican named Paul Finley, who was from sort of Corn Belt, Illinois. He had been in Congress for 22 years. He was a very, very popular congressman from Illinois. But when he started to talk out about Palestinians and about how there could be peace by, you know, negotiating with Palestinians, at that time you weren't supposed to even use that word. And because he brought up this aspect of foreign policy, he was targeted for defeat. A great deal of money was funneled to his opponent, and he lost his election after 22 years in Congress. He then wrote a book about that called They Dare to Speak Out that goes into detail, because then he looked into not only what had happened to him, but what has happened to other Congress people. A number of them also Republicans. It turns out that Chuck Percy, a very popular congressman, actually in this case a senator from Illinois, one of those people that was being considered possibly a presidential candidate because he was popular among both Republicans and Democrats and had a real shot at becoming president. He also made some statements that were displeasing to the Israel lobby, and he was similarly pushed out of office. It happened to Pete McCloskey from California, another Californian, another who was being, I remember both of these men being, you know, very popular, talked about as potential presidential candidates. I had never known why they sort of faded away from the scene. But in Paul Finley's book, and then they themselves have made statements about this, just like Cynthia McKinney. They were targeted by the Israel lobby. Campaign donations went to their opponents, and they were forced out. Earl Hilliard, more recently, this is a Democratic candidate from Alabama, the first, I think, African-American from Alabama to hold such a high office. He was in the U.S. Congress. Also got pushed out because of his statements regarding Palestine.
Now, there are many lobbies in Washington, the gun lobby, the pharmaceutical lobby, different industries have a lobby. How is the lobby for Israel any different than just pushing for a cause in Washington?
Well, it's similar on the one hand. As you say, there are special interest lobbies that are very powerful in Washington, D.C. We know that. What makes this one even more powerful and unusual is, first of all, most people don't even know about it. AIPAC, the American Israel Public Affairs Committee, is largely unknown to many, many, many people who have heard of the gun lobby, who, you know, were aware there used to be a tobacco lobby, et cetera. those same people often don't know about AIPAC, even though Fortune magazine lists it among the two most powerful lobbies in Washington, D.C. The other thing is that it is far more, it's a lobby for a foreign country, unlike those other lobbies that you just mentioned. This is a lobby on behalf of a foreign country. Normally, that such an entity is required to register as a foreign agent. There's a whole, you know, way that this is regulated. It's permissible, but it's regulated, and it's disclosed. The Israel lobby, sometimes the Justice Department has gone after AIPAC, but again, it gets quashed in the process, and the Justice Department is unable to go after it. So that's a way that it's very different than other lobbies. And the third way I would suggest is it's much more pervasive, because it's not just AIPAC. It's, as Cynthia McKinney mentions, the Anti-Defamation League is very much part of it. The Jewish Community Relations Councils that are in almost every city in the United States, on their websites openly announce that they advocate for Israel. So it's a much more pervasive and embedded lobby than other special interest lobbies. And I guess the final point where it's different is most lobbies do have a counter lobby. And usually over time there's some sort of balance, or at least there's debate and discussion about it. In this case, there has been almost no counter lobby, no debate, and only recently is there becoming a public discussion about it.
Wow. Allison, we have someone calling in who is interested in just asking a question. And I have been hearing about the Israel lobby, and people have been amazed, actually, at the number of calls that have come in during this Gaza invasion, how many people have been trying to end the Israeli assault on Gaza and calling on Congress to do so, but yet no congressperson or senator has stood up to do that. We've got David on the line. David, what's your question or comment? Very quickly.
Yeah, morning. I had heard years ago that Israeli bonds, I guess starting in, 1946, 48 or so, you know, they were seen as some sort of a great patriotic thing. And as I understand it, many unions got invested in them, but they've never, ever paid a dividend. And as I understand it, there have been various efforts to divest from them. But, in fact, I think Minnesota created an effort to divest from them about 5 or 10 years ago. And they were actually, even though it's, if a bond never makes a profit or never pays a dividend, then it actually, unions are precluded from ever investing in them, but they are actually locked into them by a court order in Minnesota. So I'm wondering if your guest is aware of this and has any ideas of how to deal with it.
Thanks so much, David. Allison, sure. Do you have any comment on the bonds, the Israel bonds that so many of the unions have, including the AFL-CIO?
Yes, I do. In fact, I've been working on an article specifically about that. I'm so glad that the caller mentioned this. These Israel bonds are being sold right now in larger and larger numbers. And whereas before they sort of targeted Israel partisans and people supporting Israel as a way to raise money for them, they then did pretend to pay out, you know, people would get their money back eventually, those that didn't just roll them over. But in the meantime, Israel devalued its currency. So basically, they lost a great deal of money on this because they weren't being paid back in the same kind of, the value of the currency had completely changed. Israel has devalued its currency at least twice. Again, most people don't know that. I had not known that, and I'm now researching this. So what we have, there was, and actually is, I believe, still a group in Minnesota called Break the Bonds that are trying to expose the Israel bond situation. Because according to a person who's researched this a great deal, a retired securities analyst and broker has looked into this, and he is writing that this is largely a Ponzi scheme, that they are selling more and more bonds, Israel bonds in the U.S., that when and if they pay them off, they're just paying them off with the money, they're paying them off with the money that they're getting from selling still more bonds. And eventually it's going to come crashing down, he feels. It's a very, very troubling situation. It's potentially a huge amount of money. It may eventually dwarf the huge direct payments that we're already giving to Israel.
Which, go ahead.
Just one thing. These bonds now, they're specifically marketing them around the United States to compete with U.S. Treasury bonds, U.S. savings bonds that a lot of people like to buy to support the American, to support the U.S. Now they're saying don't buy bonds that support the U.S. Buy these Israel bonds because we will allegedly give you a larger payout.
Mm. And you mentioned U.S. direct aid to Israel. I just want to quickly ask about that. How much aid the U.S. does give to Israel? And I understand there was also supplemental aid that the U.S. supplied during the last month of this Israeli invasion of Gaza.
Yes, according to the Congressional Research Service, this last year the amount of aid to Israel has been about $8.5 million per day to Israel, far more than to any other country on Earth, even though Israel is one of the smallest on the planet. On top of this, Congress has just been voting additional money to Israel. Some of it, I believe, has already gone through, about $225 million on top of what Israel was already getting. And they're proposing, and no doubt this will just roll right over, they're proposing in total about $620 million more to Israel in 2015. We're now looking at what will be about $10 million per day to Israel. And that doesn't even count the additional costs to Americans, which one Foreign Service analyst some years ago placed at a cost to Americans of $15 million per day. Because we're paying interest on this money, we don't really have it. In fact, interestingly, this latest $225 million that was just voted by Congress, with eight people opposing it, out of those hundreds of Congress people, at least eight people did oppose it. But one person did briefly oppose it, and it was a fiscal conservative, a Republican, who said that this should not go through because it would add to the budget deficit. But the Israel lobby is so powerful that even though this will add to a deficit, something that most people, especially Republicans, are concerned about, it just went through anyway. And now we have Netanyahu meeting with U.S. lawmakers who have come to Israel, and he has specifically told them, according to the Jewish Post, this is, I believe just came out today, he's urging these members of Congress to help Israel elude the charges of war crimes charges that no doubt should be coming against Israel and may come against Israel. Netanyahu in Israel is publicly calling on U.S. Congress to help him elude war crimes charges.
Mm. So the U.S. role is really key to what's happening in Israel and Palestine right now. Unfortunately, we are about out of time on this hour. If you want to find out more about what Allison Weir has been talking about, go to the website ifamericansknew.org. It talks about if Americans knew what was really going on in Israel and Palestine, they would not be pledging support to Israel if they found out the reality on the ground, and provides a lot of resources and background information on what is really happening. Also, if you're interested in finding out more about the Israel bonds and what unions are invested and how to divest, you can go to bdsmovement.net. That stands for Boycott, Divest, and Sanctions. bdsmovement.net for more information about that. Thank you so much, Allison, for joining us today on KBOO.
Thank you.
This is Jenka Soderberg reporting for KBOO. We're going to go out with a song by David Rovix, Israel Geography 101.
Netanyahu's in a tizzy. His eyes are filled with hate. He said the problem with those Arabs is they won't recognize a Jewish state. He said those Palestinians just won't come around to accepting Jewish rule on their holy ground. He said the Arabs don't accept their new neighbors in the hood. Those ungrateful regimes don't respect us as they should. Well, I don't want to upset anyone or unduly take to task, but if a state wants recognition, it seems reasonable to ask. Where are your borders? Where are your borders? Where are your borders? Where are your borders? I heard him speaking to the kind. Congress, getting his 29th standing O. He said, we need our security from those terrorists, don't you know? Well, if you want security, I wonder if you'd say it's true that the Palestinians should have security too. Because if you want security...
We're now approaching Newport, Rhode Island.
KBOO and the Clinton Street Theater are proud to present one of the great concert films of all time, Jazz on a Summer's Day, a documentary of the 1958 Newport Jazz Festival. Jazz on a Summer's Day captures the music, the crowd, and the essence of such jazz greats as Louis Armstrong, Thelonious Monk, Jerry Mulligan, and Anita O'Day. Jazz on a Summer's Day, Thursday, August 14, 7 p.m. at the Clinton Street Theater, 2522 Southeast Clinton Street, Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
Old Rockin' Chair's got me.
Old Rockin' Chair got your father.
Monday, August 18th at 6:30 p.m., join KBOO at the Clinton for a screening of Woodstock, the director's cut. This landmark concert film is the definitive record of that 3-day cultural event. Director Michael